Good evening. My name is Mark Schwain, and as village philosopher, it's my special pleasure tonight to defer to the more graceful muse of poetry and to introduce Brad Beenow, who will in turn introduce us all to Robert Frost. It's especially a pleasure for me to do this because we happily discovered, as we were talking earlier, our mutual love for Frost. In fact, last summer, both of us were here, though our stays didn't overlap, and at that time, Brad already had done some oral interpretations of Robert Frost, and I arrived on the scene, unfortunately, after he left and did some teaching of Frost poetry, so we both have a deep and long-standing love for his work. Brad is a seminarian, currently at Trinity Seminary in Columbus, Ohio, and his, real deep love for Frost began a couple of years ago, he tells me, when, while studying for a year at Princeton Theological Seminary, he was introduced to Frost by one of his teachers there and has been an avid student of his poetry ever since. Jim Fish pointed out to me just before coming in here that there's a current essay in the back of current issue of Time magazine, which is entitled America Needs a Poet Laureate, Maybe. And that seemed especially timely because I guess in my own view, of all poets who would have been most deserving to be America's Poet Laureate, Robert Frost, it seems to me, would have been the clearest choice. Well, I won't say any more and simply introduce Brad Beenow to you now, who will introduce Frost to us all.
Thank you. I'm going out to clean the pasture spring. I'll only stop to rake the leaves away and wait to watch the water clear, I may. I shan't be gone long. You come too. I'm going out to clean the pasture spring. And I'm going out to fetch the little calf that's standing by its mother. It's so young it totters when she licks it with her tongue. I shan't be gone long. You come too. That poem is The Pasture, and I like to use that as an introduction for two reasons. One, because Robert Frost used it as an introduction to every book of poetry that he ever wrote, save the very first, so he liked it. And I think it's an especially good way to invite all of us into the world of Robert Frost. It probably needs to be said that the world of Robert Frost is not at all unlike our own world. He lived in a rural setting most of his life. He was in touch with the land, as many of us are. I think that the genius of his gift was that he was simply able to see all of the ordinary things that you and I see and then describe them in a very unique fashion. The next poem that I want to do is called Fire and Ice, which I think we at Holden can relate to real well. Fire, obviously. Couple miles up on a mountain, ice. I like to do this early on in the format of things because it talks about matter and spirit, and I think that to understand Robert Frost, we need to pay attention to that. Frost liked to say matter in terms of spirit and spirit in terms of matter. Fire and ice are of course very common elements, but as with so much of his poetry, he uses those common elements to talk on an emotional level, to say things in a way that I think all of us can relate to. Fire and ice. Some say the world will end in fire. Some say in ice. From what I've tasted of desire, I'll hold with those who favor fire. But if it had to perish twice, I think I know enough of hate to say that for destruction, ice is also great and would suffice. I guess what most of us think of Robert Frost, we think of the man who lived on a New England farm most of his life, maybe all of his life. That wasn't really all of Robert Frost's life. He grew up in San Francisco, was born there in 1874, His father was a very political man, also a journalist. Probably would not be unfair to say that his father, William Prescott Frost, was a rabble-rouser. He drank too much. He partied in a wild fashion. He made home life often not very pleasant for Mrs. Frost and the Frost children. But Robert Frost grew up for the first 10 years of his life in an urban environment, San Francisco, in the 1870s. And I don't think I need to tell you too much about what that must have been like. This next poem is a very short one. It's called In Divey's Dive. And I always had trouble understanding this poem. How could Robert Frost write a poem like this? Until I got in touch a little bit with some of his father's doings and some of his own growing up in San Francisco, where his father would take him around on some of the political circuits, and undoubtedly they would go in and out of some of these dives. And as I think was the case with much of Frost's poetry, he reached far back into his childhood days at a later point in his life and captured some memory or some notion, some vivid image, and brought it out in a poem. And in this case, I think it's a gem, In Divey's Dive. It is late at night, and still I am losing. But still I am steady and unaccusing. As long as the Declaration guards my right to be equal in number of cards, it is nothing to me who runs this dive. Let's have a look at another five. Frost lived, as we said, in New England, but in between an early period in New England and a later period in New England, he spent about 2.5 years in England and said that he felt in some ways he had to go back to Old England to understand what New England was really all about. While he was in Old England, his first two books of poetry were published. Probably some of his finest and most memorable poems came out in those first two volumes. At least they set the tone for what was to follow, and they were very well received almost immediately. This next poem is a poem out of that second volume. It's called Mending Wall. And as he was over in Old England, he thought back to an experience he had had in New England with one of his neighbors, a French Canadian by the name of Napoleon Gay, who was his next door neighbor. And separating their two farms was this stone wall, which we have some of those here in the village, and you may know what I'm talking about. Not so much the ones like right out here that are held together by concrete, but if you go down the road a third of a mile away or so to the miners' village, you'll see walls that are just made out of stones, stacked one on top of the other. Frost mused about this and said, I wonder why it is and what it is that makes these walls fall apart. Somehow they seem to undo themselves. And in the springtime, my poor neighbor and I have to go out and, as he says, set the wall between us once again. Well, as always, he leads us through lots of nice lyrics and some humorous, funny thoughts, but really grabs us at the end with a rather profound thought. Mending wall. Something there is that doesn't love a wall, that sends the frozen groundswell under it and spills the upper boulders in the sun and makes gaps that even two could pass abreast. And the work of hunters is another thing. I've come after them and made repair where they've left not one stone on a stone, but they would have the rabbit out of hiding to please the yelping dogs. The gaps, I mean. No one has seen them made or heard them made, but at spring mending time, we find them there. I let my neighbor know beyond the hill, and on a day we meet to set the wall between us once again. We keep the wall between us as we go. To each, the boulders that have fallen to each. And some are loaves, and some so nearly balls that we have to use a spell to make them balance. Stay where you are till our backs are turned. We wear our fingers rough handling them. Oh, it's just another kind of outdoor game. One on a side, it comes to little more. There where it is, we do not need a wall. He is all pine tree, and I am apple orchard. my apple trees will never get across and eat the cones under his pines, I tell him. He only says, good fences make good neighbors. Spring is the mischief in me, and I wonder if I could plant a notion in his head. Why do they make good neighbors? Isn't it where there are cows? But here we have no cows. Before I built a wall, I'd ask to know what I was walling in or walling out, and to whom I was like to give offense. Something there is that doesn't love a wall, that wants it down. I could say elves to him, but it isn't elves exactly, and I'd rather he said it for himself. I see him there, bringing a stone grasped firmly by the top in each hand like an old stone savage armed. He moves in darkness, as it seems to me. Not of woods only and shade of trees, but he will not go behind his father's saying, and he likes having thought of it so well. He says again, good fences make good neighbors. I guess in some ways that poem points out that Robert Frost was a maverick. Let's hear it for the mavericks. He didn't like to do things in conventional ways. He had a very clear conception most of his literary life of how he wanted to write poetry and how he wanted to teach others about poetry. And I think just the notion you can get out of that poem that he often ran counter to the normal kinds of ways of seeing things. This next poem, again, is rather light and humorous, but with a very telling last couple of lines. I think if you listen carefully, you'll hear Frost taking some cracks at his critics. People who were suggesting to him in the early 20th century that, Robert, you're just not writing the way that people are writing poetry today. Free verse is where it's at. And you're not writing free verse. What's wrong with you? And Robert Frost's reply was, writing poetry in free verse is like playing tennis with the net down. Anybody can do that. He says, I like to write poetry that requires some skill in fitting things together in a metrical and a symmetrical pattern. So listen carefully for the last couple lines of this poem, and I think you'll see what I mean. The title of the poem, though, is called A Considerable Speck. This is for Mary Schramm, wherever she might be, one of her favorites. A speck that would have been beneath my sight on any but a paper sheet so white, set off across what I had written there. And I had idly poised my pen in air to stop it with a period of ink when something strange about it made me think, this was no dust speck by my breathing blown, but unmistakably a living mite with inclinations it could call its own. It paused as with suspicion of my pen, and then came racing wildly on again to where my manuscript was not yet dry. And then paused again, and either drank or smelt with loathing, for again it turned to fly. It seemed too tiny to have room for feet, yet must have had a set of them complete to express how much it didn't want to die. It faltered. I could see it hesitate, and then, in the middle of the open sheet, cower down in desperation to accept whatever I accorded it of fate. I have none of the tenderer than thou collectivistic regimenting love with which the modern world is being swept. But this poor microscopic item now, since it was nothing I knew evil of, I let it lie there till I hope it slept. I have a mind myself, and recognize mind when I meet with it in any guise. No one can know how glad I am to find on any sheet the least display of mind.
part of Robert Frost's theory about writing poetry was, as he said it, the aim is song. And one person has written a biography about Robert Frost with that title, The Aim Was Song. He wanted to make the words do the singing. And interestingly, he always objected to efforts to put any of his poetry to music. He wanted the poems themselves to be able to do the singing. This next poem has been suggested by some, at least one person, to be the most perfectly formulated poem in the English language. It's really not terribly profound, but it is very well formulated. And it's called Neither Out Far Nor In Deep. And it talks about the phenomena that I'm sure every one of us has experienced. You go to the beach. About a month ago, I was at Ocean City, Maryland, and I checked this out myself. I walked about a half a mile up and down the beach each way. What do people look at when they're at the beach? They look at the water. And Frost is trying to say in this poem, the water is terribly dull. It's the same story over and over again, wave after wave. What's behind all these people? Infinitely more interesting. But, no, they look at the water. Neither out far nor in deep. The people along the sand all turn and look one way. They turn their back on the land. They look at the sea all day. As long as it takes to pass, a ship keeps raising its hull, and the wetter sand, like glass, reflects a standing gull. Well, the land may vary more, but whatever the case may be, the water comes ashore, and the people look at the sea. They cannot look out far. They cannot look in deep, but when was that ever a bar to any watch they keep? I kind of get the feeling if Robert Frost were writing poetry today, he'd write a poem something like that about television. You can't look in very far. It's certainly not very deep. What's going on around us in the real world is infinitely more interesting, but for some crazy reason, we get hooked on the dull and the monotonous. I'd like to turn in a little more serious vein to a few of Frost's more serious poems. We misunderstand Robert Frost if we see him only as a kind of sentimental, naturalist-type poet. He very strenuously objected when people tried to cast him in that vein, and I think rightly so. Frost knew what pain was all about in his own life. His father died when he was 10 years old. His mother suffered an agonizing illness before she died. His wife died some 30 years before he did, and he lived a long time by himself. And one of his sons committed suicide. So Frost was not immune to what pain is all about. And I think this next poem, which is very short, is the best definition of empathy that I've ever read, and it's called Lodged. The rain to the wind said, "You push and I'll pelt." And they so smote the garden bed that the flowers actually knelt and lay there, lodged, though not dead. I know how the flowers felt. One of the things that I think is very particularly a part of Robert Frost's genius is that he could sum up in a title of a poem what the whole poem was about. And very seldom, if ever, was the title a line or even a word from the poem itself. If you think of Mending Wall, for instance, that pretty well says it in the title. This next poem is entitled Bereft. It's a word we don't use much, but I think it's loaded with meaning. And it says it all. The title says it all. Frost wrote this poem out of a very personal experience that he had back a couple years after he had gotten out of high school. He was staying with his wife-to-be and her sister and a couple other people of her family on an old farm up in New Hampshire, the old Saunders place it was called, high on a hill, looked downhill to a lake, and it was an old farmhouse. And this poem was written out of a bereft feeling that Frost had when his wife-to-be went back to college. He was very uncertain as to whether Eleanor was ever going to fall in love with him and marry him. It caused him great anxiety. And again, it was only later that he reached back and captured this feeling and put it together in this poem called Bereft. Where had I heard this wind before change like this to a deeper roar? What would it take my standing there for, holding open a restive door, looking downhill to a frothy shore? Summer was past, and day was past, and somber clouds in the west were massed. Out in the porch's sagging floor, leaves got up in a coil and hissed, blindly struck at my knee and missed. Something sinister in their tone told me my secret must be known. Word that I was in the house alone somehow must have gotten abroad. Word I was in my life alone. Word I had no one left but God. That's about as close to theological as Robert Frost would ever get. But I think what he's saying in that poem is very theological. I like the way that poem points us downward, downhill to a frothy shore. Everything points downward, as if to say you really discover your need for God when you hit the bottom of the descent. I think that's kind of a theological notion. This next poem is, I put these two together because they're the only theological poems I know that he wrote. This next poem is called Not All There. I can really identify with this. I don't know about you. It's a dialogue. Frost liked to write about dialogues. He liked to talk to things, and we'll share a couple more poems where he talks to things. But in this case, he's talking with God. Certainly not a thing, but it's a dialogue called Not All There. I turn to speak to God about the world's despair. To make bad matters worse, I found God wasn't there. God turned to speak to me. Don't anybody laugh. God found I wasn't there. At least not over half. Certainly there are those days when you feel that way. We move from the theological to the nonsensical. This poem is called Departmental, which doesn't tell you anything about the poem. But the title that he wanted to use tells you a lot about the poem, which was The End of My Aunt Jerry, A-N-T, Aunt. It's about bugs. He liked bugs for some reason. Observing the considerable speck, you know, he got a notion of a mind. He looked at ants and said, pretty clever little critters here. They really have a few good things going. But as always, he gets around at the end to a really profound point. And if I recall correctly, this poem was written during the time he was on the faculty at Amherst. Wasn't getting along with the administration too well. Didn't really like administration. Didn't like bureaucracy and departments and all that stuff. And so in a subtle kind of satirical way, he pokes fun at that. So I dedicate this to the some of the people who I was serving in Alexandria, Virginia this year who were bureaucrats, and as we talked about here a little while back in the session. Poem is called Departmental. An ant on the tablecloth ran into a dormant moth of many times its size. Showed not the least surprise, his business wasn't with such. He gave it scarcely a touch and was off on his duty run. Yet, If he encountered one of the hive's inquiry squad, whose work it is to find out God and the nature of time and space, he would have put him onto the case. Ants are a curious race. One crossing with hurried tread the body of one of its dead isn't given a moment's rest, seems not even impressed, but he no doubt reports to any with whom he crosses antennae, and they no doubt report to the higher up at court. And then the word goes forth informic. Death's come to Jerry McCormick. Our selfless forager Jerry, will the special Janissary, whose office it is to bury the dead of the commissary, go bring him home to his people, lay him in state on a sepal, wrap him for shroud in a petal, embalm him with ichor of nettle. This is the word of your queen. And presently on the scene appears a solemn mortician. And taking formal position with feelers calmly a-twiddle, he seizes him by the middle, and heaving him high in the air, he carries him out of there. No one stands round to stare, it's no one else's affair. It couldn't be called ungentle, but how thoroughly departmental. I like that. Probably can notice from that poem the absolute genius of Robert Frost to rhyme words. Words you'd never think of putting together. Janissary, commissary, berry. I mean, who knows, but they all fit perfectly. Just, that's genius. I can't think of any other word for that. The next poem I want to do moves us back into a little more serious vein. It's called Hyla Brook, which maybe bears a little explanation. The word Hyla refers to a breed of frogs, the Hyla frogs, that were found on Frost's farm in Derry, New Hampshire. And they had a brook that they called the Hyla Brook because that's where the Hyla frogs hung out. But Frost was pretty closely in tune to the changing of the seasons, I'm sure as you know. And while we probably don't notice this much here at Holden, because our streams are glacier-fed, in a place where when the summer heat comes, streams dry up, this is very noticeable, and Frost starts out saying that by June, our brooks run out of song and speed. It's dried up. And you've got to remember a pretty long way back to remember what this dry creek bed really was. There's a fantastic insight in this poem, I think, that we can apply interpersonally. It says something about seeing past the surface of a person. And I know that, especially as I deal with elderly people, I have to keep this in mind. These are not people who were born old yesterday. They've got lots and lots of years behind them, behind some of you, lots and lots of years. I need to remember that and to look back and be one of those people who can remember long. And in the last line of the poem, Robert Frost says, "We love the things we love for what they are. We don't despise them for what they aren't. We love them for what they are, whether we can always see it or not." And I have to give special mention here to Paul Wee, who some of you will remember from having been here last summer. When we did this session last summer, afterwards, Paul asked me if I knew this poem, and I didn't. And he quoted part of it for me, and it was so meaningful that I set about the task of committing it to memory. So I want to remember him and attribute to him some of the insight from this poem. Hyla Brook. By June our brooks run out of song and speed. Sought for much after that it will be found either to have gone underground and taken with it all the Hyla breed that shouted in the mist a month ago like ghost of sleigh bells in a ghost of snow, or to have flourished and come up in jewel weed, weak foliage that is blown upon and bent even against the way its waters went. Its bed is left a faded paper sheet of dead leaves stuck together by the heat. A brook to none but who remember long. This, as it will be seen, is other, far than with brooks taken otherwhere in song. We love the things we love for what they are. Robert Frost was a great walker. He loved to walk. And this next poem is about that. It's called Good Hours. I feel like I can identify with this poem quite a bit because I like to walk, and it's nice to walk late at night. And I could remember walking on some of those kind of snowy winter evenings that he describes in this poem. I have to tell a humorous story. When Frost started his college days at Dartmouth, didn't last very long, only lasted about 6 months and quit. He couldn't really stand formal education. But anyway, he would go out on these long walks late in the evening. And some of his fraternity brothers started to get a little worried about him. And finally, they came to him and they said, Robert, what do you do on those long walks in the woods by yourself all night? And Robert Frost, who was never at a loss for words and didn't like to be asked those kind of questions anyway, said, I gnaw bark. So, but this poem, which is about a walk, is called it's called Good Hours. I had for my winter evening walk no one at all with whom to talk. But I had the cottages in a row, up to their shining eyes in snow. And I thought, I had the folk within. I had the sound of a violin, and I thought I saw through curtain laces youthful forms and youthful faces. I had such company, outward bound. I went till there were no cottages found. I turned and repented, but coming back, I saw no cottage but that was black. Over the snow, my creaking feet disturbed the slumbering village street like profanation. By your leave at 10 o'clock of a winter eve. The next poem I want to share is undoubtedly familiar to everyone who's ever read a bit of Robert Frost. Probably one of the two poems you read first is this one, A Road Not Taken. Again, the genius of being able to say in the title everything that the poem is really about, and yet never uses the title in the poem as such. I guess I'd want to point out especially that we pay attention to the fact that the poet never says whether he's happy or whether he's sad about the choice that he's made. I think we sometimes jump to the conclusion that always the noble thing to do is take that path less trodden. That's somehow noble and virtuous. Frost never necessarily says that. He lets us be a part of the poem. Again, the genius of his writing. We have to get involved with it. We have to be there on the scene, make that decision for ourselves. And it paints such a clear visual image of two roads. I guess I always think of the trail to Holden Lake where it splits, Holden to the right and Heart Lake to the left. And it's such a clear image of what he's trying to say. This poem goes with a little bit of a dedication to Will Mochon, who you may remember that was here last summer. I recall that this was a very favorite of his and meant a lot to him. The Road Not Taken. Two roads diverged in a yellow wood. And sorry, I could not travel both and be one traveler. Long I stood and looked down one as far as I could to where it bent in the undergrowth. and then took the other. Just as fair, and having perhaps the better claim, because it was grassy and wanted wear. Though as for that, the passing there had worn them really about the same. And both that morning equally lay in leaves, no step had trodden black. Oh, I saved the first for another day. Yet, knowing how way leads on to way, I doubted if I should ever come back. I shall be telling this tale with a sigh somewhere, ages and ages hence. Two roads diverged in a wood, and I took the one less traveled by, and that has made all the difference. I also find in that poem the curious way that he is able to bring out his own both ambivalence and rationalizing qualities. Frost was a great rationalizer in a lot of ways, but at the same time when he could say one was grassy and wanted wear, he could also say, but they were really about the same. So I can rationalize doing what I do because one really doesn't deserve any more attention than the other. That, to me, that's such a basic human notion there that he's tapped into. Wanting to do the noble thing, but always having some ambivalence about it and then leading to some rationalization, I guess you'd say. The next poem is called Two Tramps in Mud Time. It sort of follows on this notion of which way do you go with your life. Mud time, is that a familiar term to anybody?
Spring thaw is what he meant, I guess.
Yeah, exactly. Maybe we don't call it mud time, but that's exactly what he meant. There's a period somewhere along in, March, late March, where it's still too cold to be called spring, but things are melting and you can't really call it winter. And he called that in more than one place, mud time. That was when it was just an in-between time. I guess that's the best way to say it. The poem is a story about two tramps, and I think this came pretty much out of a real experience, although he sort of enhanced it to fit it into a poem. Two tramps who caught him splitting wood, and they wanted to know if, as he says, they could take my job for pay. He has some problems with this. Why should he let these freeloaders do what he loves to do? But again, he knows there's some ambivalent feelings going on when he says, I know they're really right. I mean, they're needy and I'm not, and I should let them do it. But he ends up by saying that, which I think is a fitting way to characterize his life, his object is to unite his avocation and his vocation. And I like that description for what our lives should be all about. It's grace if we can realize that, the unification of an avocation and a vocation. Certainly, I would say that's what Robert Frost was all about. Two tramps in mud time. I gotta say one more thing. I can really identify with this poem because it talks about splitting wood, and I recall one time last summer, on a day off or something, I got feeling real generous and gracious and decided to split some wood out here by Koinonia because we never had any to build fires. And so I love this. Great. Have you ever split wood? Great experience. Recommend it to everybody. Put a wedge in there and one shot splits a piece of wood right open. Well, I got so carried away. I was doing this right out here. We're not watching what I was doing. I split a piece and it fell right onto the water line out here. Which used to stick out about this far. Now it sticks out about this far. It fell on there and it broke all, and I had my own mud time because it got shot all over and I got wet. So let's throw that in. Two tramps in mud time. Out of the mud, two strangers came and caught me splitting wood in the yard. And one of them put me off my aim by hailing cheerily, "Hit them hard!" I knew pretty well why he stayed behind and let the other go on away. I knew pretty well what he had in mind. He wanted to take my job for pay. Good blocks of oak it was I split, as large around as the chopping block. And every piece I squarely hit fell splinterless as a cloven rock. The blows that a life of self-control spares to strike for the common good, that day, giving a loose to my soul, I spent on the unimportant wood. The sun was out, but the wind was chill. You know how it is on an April day when the sun is warm and the wind is still? You're 1 month on in the middle of May. But if you so much as dare to speak, a cloud comes over the sunlit arch, a wind comes off the frozen peak, and you're 2 months back in the middle of March. A bluebird comes tenderly up to alight and turns to the wind to unruffle a plume. His song, so pitched so as not to excite a single flower as yet to bloom. It is snowing a flake, and he half knew winter was only playing possum. Except in color, he isn't blue, and he wouldn't advise a thing to blossom. The water, for which we may have to look in summertime with a witching wand, in every wheel rut is now a brook, in every print of hoof a pond. Well, be glad of water, but don't forget the lurking frost in the earth beneath. That will steal forth after the sun is set and show on the water its crystal teeth. The time when most I loved my task. These two must make me love it more by coming with what they came to ask. You'd think I'd never felt before the weight of an axe head poised aloft, the grip on earth of outspread feet, the life of muscles rocking soft and smooth and moist in vernal heat. Out of the mud, two hulking
Nothing on either side was said. They knew they had but to stay their stay, and all their logic would fill my head, as that I had no right to play at what was another man's work for gain. My right might be love, but theirs was need. And where the two exist in twain, theirs was the better right, agreed. But yield who will to their separation. My object in living is to unite my avocation and my vocation, as my two eyes make one insight. Only where love and need are one, and the work is play, for mortal stakes is the deed ever really done, for heaven and the future's sakes. Thank you. This next poem is called Provide, Provide, one of the rare instances when the title comes out of the poem. I wonder in some ways, and I don't know what the sequence when these two poems were written, but it almost seems like this poem is a response to those two tramps. Frost had a very pragmatic side to him, as well as a strong individual kind of an ethic, and I guess that's why he kind of resisted those tramps who wanted to freeload. This poem simply says, hey, however you can do it, get what you can get while the getting's good, and get it quick. It kind of reminds me of the parable of the dishonest steward. Remember the guy who used unscrupulous means to accomplish something relatively worthwhile. Called Provide, Provide. Also uses the name Abishag. Does that mean anything to anybody who is?
Yes. She was a young maiden who was put in with the old David.
Yeah.
He knew her not and went ahead and died anyway.
Right. The beautiful. Yeah, right. Well, you'll catch on to how he uses that in the poem. It comes in the very first stanza. Called Provide, Provide. The witch that came, the withered hag, to wash the steps with pail and rag, was once the beauty Abishag. The picture pride of Hollywood. Too many fall from great and good for you to doubt the likelihood. Die early and avoid the fate. Or, if predestined to die late, make up your mind to die in state. Make the whole stock exchange your own. If need be, occupy a throne where no one can call you crone. Some have relied on what they knew, others on being simply true. What worked for them might work for you. No memory of having starred atones for later disregard or keeps the end from being hard. Better to go down dignified with boughten friendship at your side than none at all. Provide. Someone asked me today what my favorite Robert Frost poem is, and I have to honestly say I don't have a favorite, but the answer I gave to this person was, I guess my favorite is whichever poem I've most recently been thinking about, which in this case is the next poem, which is Birches, and I've just recently been going over that and committing it to memory. The poem tells a fantastic story. It's a marriage of the old and the young. He talks about the young boy who was a swinger of birches, and I don't know how to really describe that phenomenon. He does a pretty good job of it in the poem. He experienced it as a young boy. You climb a birch tree, which is pretty supple and bends a lot. You get clear up to the top, and you swing it back and forth, and it'll bend far enough down you can let yourself down to the ground, and then it snaps back up. He describes some of what that's all about, but with a real sensitivity to nature and how all this happens, and with an incredible sort of a whimsical looking back from a point later in life, wishing to somehow recapture some of the little boy in him. When I see birches bend to left and right across the lines of straighter, darker trees, I like to think some boy's been swinging them. But swinging doesn't bend them down to stay as ice storms do. Often, you must have seen them, loaded with ice a sunny winter morning after a rain. They click together as the breeze rises and turn many colored as the stir cracks and crazes their enamel. Soon the sun's warmth makes them shed crystal shells, shattering and avalanching on the snow crust such heaps of broken glass to sweep away you'd think the inner dome of heaven had fallen. They are dragged to the withered bracken by the load, and they seem not to break, though once bowed so low for long, they never seem to right themselves. You may see their trunks arching forward in the woods years afterwards, trailing their leaves on the ground like girls on hands and knees who throw their hair over their heads before them in the sun to dry. But I was about to say, when Truth broke in with all her matter of fact about the ice storm, that I should prefer to have some boy bend them as he went out and in to fetch the cows. Some boy too far from town to learn baseball, whose only play was what he found himself, summer or winter, and could play alone. One by one he subdued his father's trees by riding them down over and over again until he took the stiffness out of them. And not one but hung limp. Not one was left for him to conquer. He learned all there was for him to learn about not launching out too soon and so not carrying the tree away clear to the ground. He always kept his poise to the top branches, climbing carefully with the same pains you would use to fill a cup up to the brim, and even above the brim. And then he flung himself outward, feet first, with a swish, kicking downward through the air to the ground. So was I, once myself, a swinger of birches. And so I dream of going back to be. It's when I'm weary of considerations and life is too much like a pathless wood where your face burns and tickles from the cobwebs having broken across it and one eye is weeping from a twig having lashed across it open. I'd like to get away from earth a while and then come back to it and begin over. May no fate willfully misunderstand me and half grant what I wish and snatch me away not to return. Earth's the right place for love. I don't know where it's likely to go better. I'd like to go by climbing a birch tree and climb black branches up a snow-white trunk toward heaven till the tree could bear no more and then dipped its top and set me down again. That would be good, both going and coming back. One could do worse than be a swinger of birches. Thank you. I have a couple more poems. I mentioned before that Frost liked to talk to things. This next poem he's talking to, of all things, is Karen Strom here. He's talking to a star. I think he got this notion from a poem by John Keats called Bright Star, in which Keats describes the star as the eternal eremite. Eremite is a term for, I guess you'd say hermit, but even more than a hermit. Somebody who totally had nothing to do with anything. And Frost uses that word, eremite, to describe the star. Again, it's funny, it's whimsical, it's a joke to hear him try to talk to the star, and the star, of course, doesn't say much. But he grabs us at the end again with a terribly profound insight, as if to say, look beyond yourselves. Take something like a star. O star, the fairest one in sight, we grant your loftiness the right to some obscurity of cloud. It will not do to say of night, for dark is what brings out your light. Some mystery becomes the proud. But to be wholly taciturn in your reserve, it's not allowed. Say something to us we can learn by heart, and when alone repeat. Say something. And it says, I burn. And steadfast as Keats' eremite, not even stooping from its sphere, it asks a little of us here. It asks of us a certain height. So when at times the mob be swayed to carry praise or blame too far, we might take something like a star to stay our minds on and be stayed. Well, it wouldn't be Robert Frost without concluding with stopping by woods on a snowy evening. This poem, as nearly as I can figure out, has a very interesting history behind it. One, if you listen to the Robert Frost version of the story, he says that he ripped this poem off just like that in about 5 minutes. That was a myth that Frost liked to perpetuate, that as he said, the poet writes in a state of grace. And when it happens, boy, does it ever really happen. It just happens. The evidence is somewhat on the other side, because he did save a lot of his first drafts, and many of those have been placed in libraries. And we know that there were several first drafts to Stopping by Woods on a Snowy Evening. But the truth behind this poem is probably this. He wrote it, or at least got started on it, very early in the morning hours when he did some of his best work. And he had worked late into the night on a long, long narrative poem called New Hampshire, which was the title poem for, I think, his third volume of poetry. He finally wrapped up this long, long poem, and he went outside, and the stars were just fading, and it was almost morning, and he said that's when he got the idea for Stopping by Woods on a Snowy Evening. It just sort of came to him. It was a couple more revisions before it came down to the form that we have it today, but I think that's kind of interesting as to how people get their ideas and how they write. But, any explanation of this poem is bound to be futile, and Frost, for the most part, resisted any interpretations on his part. He said it sounded good, it was a song in itself, you figure it out. Stopping by Woods on a Snowy Evening. Whose woods these are, I think I know. His house is in the village, though. He will not see me stopping here to watch his woods fill up with snow. My little horse must think it queer to stop without a farmhouse near. Between the woods and frozen lake, the darkest evening of the year. He gives his harness bells a shake to ask if there is some mistake. The only other sounds the sweep of easy wind and downy flake. The woods are lovely, dark, and deep. But I have promises to keep, and miles to go before I sleep, and miles to go before I sleep. I close with four lines from a long poem called A Lesson for Today. Use these because I guess it sums up for me about as well as anything what Robert Frost was all about. And he says that this way. Were an epitaph to be my story, I'd have a short one ready for my own. I would have written of me on my stone. He had a lover's quarrel with the world.